I was thinking that there might be, I mean, there definitely is, and we might want to go more into this thing about intimacy and sex, and why is it that, or how is it that, that there's this correlation? I mean, that intimacy should become as charged as sex already is. And yet, as you're pointing out, and a part of this, that sex is becoming more and more, I mean, less and less charged in a sense. Okay, so a couple of like extreme, hey, kitty cat, examples. What I mean, like in Britain now, a significant percentage of students at universities are sex workers, and although it's kind of a weird liminal time because prostitution hasn't been legalized in Britain, as far as I know, but these sex workers are, you know, protected, and they have, I don't know if they have unions, but there are organizations that are facilitating, and it's generally being, I could even say pushed, but I don't want to load my language too much because it's particularly because it's so sensitive. But there's a sort of general movement towards accepting this as just a healthy way for students, probably mostly female, to earn money, pay off their student debts, is by prostituting themselves.
And again, that even the word healthy is a very loaded, right? Is it a healthy way?
Right, even the question that this might not be healthy, okay, so yeah,
This,
it's.
yeah. At the risk of making a bold statement that I haven't fully thought out, my feelings around it are that it's all right, like feminism, modern feminism. Hey, buddy, I need to chop off here. Modern
It's
feminism.
enough intimacy for one
Well,
day.
this seems like a menage a trois. I can't be intimate with my cat and you at the same time. This is it's why that never works. Or at least not in my world. So feminism, obviously a man, I might not fully get it. Like, I know, all right, full disclosure, I don't know if you know this, like, I worked, years ago, I worked as a video editor for an adult film company.
I did not know that.
So, I actually even, was the cameraman for a few shoots and directed a few shoots and things like that. Which was, actually, like, for me, it was a devastating experience. Like, not like the least erotic thing I could imagine. It wasn't, I just want, like I said, it's not to, all right, well, sorry, but I learned a number of things through it. One is I learned that for me, I didn't find it a turn on at all. Like, there was nothing erotic about, like, okay, like, one day I'm sitting at work and, like, my boss comes in and he's like, "Oh, hey, I need you to stop what you're doing, grab a camera. This girl's gonna come in, just have her take off her clothes and take a bunch of different pictures of her, and, blah, blah, blah." That sounds like an awesome fucking day. I'm getting paid to just someone be like, "Hey, here's this beautiful woman's gonna come in, take some pictures of her."
Yeah.
But again, if I'm awkward about, we have the social anxiety around, is this comfortable that we shake hands? It's even more strange to be like, "Oh, hi, miss. Nice to meet you. Hey, so I need you to bend over and show me your asshole so I can take a picture of it." Like, really fucking weird. It's really fucking weird, right? So, as I said, it was a learning experience for me, is I learned that there were some people who, it was a very sad, like, clearly sad experience. The girl I just gave an example of, she was a very, not, I don't think, underage girl. I don't want to say, like, when I say very young, but just to say, like, inexperienced, I don't know, in their full, someone could be 18 and still not be that very mature.
Sure, of course.
And she had a coke addiction. So, okay, she needs the money to get so she can buy some more fucking coke. It feels predatory for me, even as a not that I'm not seeking her out, I'm not anything, but to be a beneficiary of this systematic moment, right? So, it was the best paying job I've ever had. Okay, let's just put that on the table here. Like, it was good fucking money, which was why it was really hard for me to not to say no and to walk away from it. But it was like it just felt wrong. But then there also came moments where I was like, that was pushed back in my face. Like, I remember there was this one day I'm working with this woman, and I don't know, I guess it was like really hitting me emotionally that day, and I made some sort of comment about, I don't know exactly what I said. It was just a sort of comment about, like, acknowledging the sad reality of what we did, or something like that. And she like looked at me like, "Fuck you." Like, this is my choice. She's like, "I have kids, I support them, I enjoy it, I'm happy with my sexuality, I enjoy what I do. I have no bad feelings about this, you know, like, you don't need to fucking save me from this or feel pity for me. This is like she fucking owned it, you know." And I feel I don't and I'll be honest with that woman in particular, I didn't feel it was like just an emotional outburst or anything. Like, it felt like that was a very legitimate, she was like a very strong person who, you know, was in full control of her destiny for whatever, you know, or like using her sexuality and the fact that men want to pay her for sex. Hey, I've got it, you want it, great, you know, and I'm gonna leverage my supply and demand and make good money and fuck you all, you know. So there were moments of like, oh, so it's not just this one-sided, you know, it's not as black and white as, oh, there's, you know, when you tell me the story of young girls in going to university and paying for it by becoming prostitutes, that sounds horrific in the sense of like and the whole system is horrific. We've created expensive school systems that you can only pay for by, I can take out, like, I'm still paying off student loans. I didn't even fucking graduate, and I don't have a certificate, but I'm still in debt to this thing. And if I had a vagina, I might be tempted to sell it to help pay that debt off, right? So the whole system is horrific. And yet I understand your point of like why it's a sensitive issue, that it's like a sex positivity, quote unquote, issue, right? Of like certain people saying like, you can't, you know, don't just judge me by saying it's a sad situation. You don't know my situation. Like, I've encountered that in a very real, visceral experience, and I think there is more legitimacy to that example than I would have ever thought. That being said, I don't think it's the majority experience. I think there is a probably a minority of people who are sex positive beneficiaries of a system that works for them, or you know, working within a system that they can feel good about, and probably a larger percentage that is women who will probably regret and again, as being a video editor of these situations, what I would see is all the things you don't see. So I have to cut out the footage of, you know, the cameras on her face as she looks really fucking depressed, you know, and we have to cut away to a shot of her vagina and moaning, you know, because you can't air that. You can't show the sadness. Do you know what I mean? Like, it ruins the fantasy. Like, that's why it was soul crushing for me, is watching these sad, unscripted, unaired moments that were again, not like, not all horrific, but definitely sometimes really, really hard to stomach. So,
Wow, well, I didn't know that was unexpected that you would have some personal testimony to bring to the table. We just kind of expanded the horizons there and deepened the terrain that we're digging in. And it was already pretty deep now, because there's just so many different things we could look at around this. And my initial reason I brought it up was to do with intimacy, and the loss of it. Now, I would argue that porn is the opposite of intimacy. Prostitution is pretty much mutually exclusive within intimacy. And this is someone who's been to prostitutes and had intimate experiences with them. So I'm certainly not saying it's a hard and fast rule. But I would also add, I mean, the only reason I went to prostitutes was because my sexuality's been so traumatized that I wasn't able to maintain an erection with someone I felt intimate with, right? So I needed that lack of intimacy.
So when you say, okay, sorry, so I just want to clarify something. You said you have had intimate experiences, but then you said you needed the lack of intimacy. I'm just curious.
Oh, well, yeah, well, it's all relative, isn't it? So relative to what, I don't know about you, but perhaps many people would expect from an encounter with a prostitute, because it was in Guatemala, so it's very different. Like, I tried to go to a prostitute when I was a 20-year-old virgin trying to get it over with, and the whole setup was so anti-intimacy, as in, like, take your clothes off, I need to wash you, that whole kind of thing, that I just walked right out. I knew there was no way I could do this physically or otherwise. So, and then that bang went my career as a sort of as a prostitute goer, which of course my brother became and wrote articles and bragged about. But so then, flash forward to 10 years later, when I had managed to lose my virginity, age 27. Lots of personal info in this podcast, but not really managed to have a long-term relationship. Well, period. Not had any long-term relationships, and not really even managed to have a girlfriend. I think once it had happened for about a month, and so really not had intimate sex. Insofar as, I mean, sex is always intimate at one level, but I mean, in terms of really knowing and loving the person. So yeah, and then in Guatemala, as part of this consciously directed shamanic sexual individuation journey, it wasn't my idea, Your Honor. I went around Guatemala and whorehouses, and so it was very different there. That it's girls who often they come from Salvador or Central America, like to Guatemala, not necessarily. I mean, there's anyway they come from all over and do it for a few years and then, make enough money to get started in there with their lives. But not that that, I mean, that's just one qualifier. Just the kind of, I don't know, the environment was much less kind of meat factory-like, and because of my uncertainty about my sexuality, there was no question of, like, here's the money, now we're going to do it. It was, here's the money, now we're going to go to your room and just see what happens. And in most cases, nothing much did happen, but and because I was a strange sort of presence, this, tall, white, European, the girls were quite curious about me and even attracted to me, so they would have been less jaded also than they would have been with regular clients. The whole context was different, and I would I don't know how intimate I should be with this, but I guess you've disclosed a lot of stuff. I had a kind of criteria, which was I didn't want to have sex with any prostitute that I wouldn't go down on. Like, that was the kind of thing. Like, it wasn't that
I
I'm going
think
to
you and I
pleasure
are.
you. It was just like, if I'm really going to be with you, then I'm going to be with you as if you were somebody I loved. And I wasn't, like, just going to use you as an object. And of course, going down on a girl doesn't mean you're not using them as an object. But somehow, to me, it was something that was a way of gauging, you know, how willing to be vulnerable I was with this person. And so that was part of it. And I think that kind of disoriented them a little bit, perhaps, because they probably didn't have clients who would do that. And then I wasn't actually trying to fuck them. I was really, the context was that it was a film about a guy who couldn't get an erection, and he was going around whore houses to try and find his happiness, try and meet the perfect prostitute, fall in love and get married. And it was this bizarre sort of gonzo thing, and that this charming guy Mitch came up with. And so I was kind of acting the whole time, even if the camera wasn't there. I was aware I was doing it for this project. So it's kind of like a porn project, weirdly. Shaman porn. What was the context for all of this? Or you just wanted me to unpack that in terms of, I guess the context was like prostitution generally doesn't allow for intimacy, or is the inverse of intimacy, in terms of it just being a transaction, right? A very impersonal transaction.
It's probably not as black and white as, right, is it one or the other? And I think
right. That's
like when I know my friend Andras, he has a woman he was involved with for many years, and she calls herself a sacred whore, that she's a sex worker, and her idea is to help people find, you know, through these, you know, lose that awkwardness, or help them through these, that you're not just paying somebody to go and fuck them, it's to work with someone, you know, almost like self-help, sexual realization, individuation, etc. And that's, again, it's really foreign to me. I'll be completely blunt. It's a very foreign concept to me, but I'm familiar enough that I can, like, conceptually I can wrap my head around it, that, like, yes, it's not black and white, like someone's being taken advantage of, someone's forced into a sort of sexual slavery, and at the same time, I know those are almost two extremes in a very complicated subject.
What's the other, the extreme of exploitation and sacred initiation, you mean?
Yeah. I'll try and say this real quick. I had, at that film, at that place where I worked, there was this one woman, and she was, for my taste, incredibly unattractive. And I was doing things like designing website stuff and DVD covers, just doing different things. And my boss, like, kept wanting me to use this woman's image, and I'm like, what? I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I didn't make business sense. Mm-hmm. She was not. I don't know how to say this without sounding like a horrible person. She was, again, for my taste, very, very unattractive. She looked like this, she was like a blonde woman that, like, was, like, looked like way overused. Like, she'd been run through the machine way too many times, you know, and just looked, like, haggard, you know, really used up. And so he says, I asked my boss, I'm like, what is it about this woman? Why are we really? And he's like, oh, you don't know who that is? He's like, well, she used to be a penthouse pet or playmate, or, you know, whatever. Like, when it's like she was something years ago, and then, you know, now she's, as her looks have sort of faded, she's had to do more and more things, right? And then at the moment, it was like this one dark realization, which is actually completely based off a false story. What he's telling me turns out to not be true. But I was like, oh, okay, this is the life cycle of a porn star, right? You could start off and be a glamour model, and I'll just take my top off and maybe take my pants off, and you take photos of me, and then as I get older and my books start to fade, I have to do more and more and more till I reach the point that I'm like taking five dicks at once to get a paycheck, you know, like, and that was a horrible realization, that moment of like, oh my God, this is the life cycle of this career path, if you want to call it that, right? Well, as I said, it turns out to be completely false, because years later, when I first, well, not like when I first, but at some point when I get into like alternative research, conspiracy stuff, all this sort of stuff, I come across this thing which is, oh God, the name escapes me in the moment. It's like, it's sort of like a process church type, like one of these, like the family, you know, like the grandfather is the head of the religion and he fucks all the kids and all the couples.
Children of God.
Yes, yes, Children of God, thank you. I come across an article, okay, like an old Scandin newspaper article about the Children of God, and I see this woman's face and her name, and she's talking about how she escaped from this cult.
Right.
And I'm thinking, here's this article, there's this woman who grew up in this abusive, horrific scenario, escapes, quote unquote, gets out on her own. And then within a few years, probably whatever the psychological trauma or whatever that I'm projecting onto this, whatever I'm assuming the missing link between her escaping from this child abuse sex cult and her ending up as a D or F list porn star is like what transpired in between these two periods, and it's, I can only imagine it's pretty horrible.
Well, I don't think you need to necessarily fill in that gap in terms of a missing piece in the narrative to make the, or to confirm the very strong correlation between childhood sexual abuse and prostitution, drug addiction, sexual promiscuity, and all the rest of it.
Right, and I just to say, like, so I had already left this job years earlier, so it wasn't like it was still like an active thing that it, like, you know, whatever. But I have to say that the moment that I saw that face, which again I had worked with this face multiple times. I never actually met her personally, but I had edited multiple footage of her and photos of her, and I just knew this face because I had discussed this face and this woman so many times. To see that face on this Child of God article in that context, like, shattered me. And all the sex positivity thing that I keep trying to kind of hold on to, that there is that other extreme, that is there is the quasi-positive side to it. I have to say that moment was a pretty hard slap in the face. To encounter that face again in that situation.
Keep your head on the ground.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did, and I'm glad that it came up into this conversation as a kind of Rosetta Stone. I mean, that's how I would choose to see it. And because my own, I during this time I'm talking about with the prostitutes, I had this belief in sacred sexuality and, tantra and polygamy and all of these ideas that were seeded in me by the culture. Not really, well, they were by my family, but not in a way that was obvious to me. But it's clear they were because of how my brother Sebastian Horsley, how he, the path that he took, it didn't come from nowhere. And so while mine was more spiritualized and his was more kind of overtly hedonistic, it was still very similar. And we both ended up sleeping loads of prostitutes and writing about it and sort of making it part of our philosophy. So that cannot be a coincidence. And we both sexually abused, I'll say that categorically now, even though there's no facts to prove it or even memories as such, but I'm absolutely sure about that. And he loved prostitutes in perhaps in a sincere way, but also in an ideological way, as in he convinced himself that they were the freest of women, the freest of women on God's earth, I think he even said, which is a sort of ultra-feminist perspective or a neo-feminist perspective now. But he also denied the existence of sexual trafficking, completely denied it on public TV. It's on YouTube. It's really shocking to see it. The whole he denied. He said it was just a myth, right? A conspiracy theory. All right. So one of the things that makes this so difficult to talk about, and so good we have personal experience to draw on, is that, again, with this sort of ideological framework, you're either for or against. Like the only, generally, the if you question the sort of growing ideology around sex work, you are a moralist, and you are pathologizing, and you are this, and you are
Yeah, you're
that. Like there's,
puritanical, prudish.
I mean, that's the first line of defense or whatever, or offensive defense, and then there's the pathologizing line. Like, how dare you suggest that this is because I was traumatized? Well, yeah, it is. It's really delicate, because if somebody's so traumatized that they don't even know it, like my brother, and fiercely deny it and insist that their way of life is a choice and an expression of their freedom of choice and their authentic soul, that's absolutely who they are, and they make a really convincing display of it to the point of becoming a celebrity doing it. Like Whitley Strieber would be another example, though he's not obviously preaching sexual freedom or the glory of prostitution, but still, somebody who becomes a very convincing spokesperson for the benefits of some experience, in Strieber's case, alien abduction or mind control, MK Ultra, or both, it's pretty hard to just say, no, sorry, you're traumatized, you're damaged. It's kind of potentially invasive. Certainly the person would experience it that way. But on the other hand, if that's the truth, then we can't just ignore it either. So it's like how to paint a picture that's broad and wide and deep enough to really show the context in which, yeah, the machinery of intimacy, that's not a contradiction in terms of just the organic experience of intimacy is being lost, and some other kind of cultural context is replacing it, which is all about sex, really. It's all about how great sex is. And if you say otherwise, you're a moralist and a prude, or you're hung up about it. But to bring it back to personal again, like having been married 7 years now, well, it's actually six, but together for 7 years, and gone through. How long have you been married?
That's bizarre as shit, but we've been together for 7 and married for 6.
Wow, that is bizarre as shit. So I don't necessarily want to go into the details because, of course, we can't talk about our marriages without talking about our wives, and that's not really fair on them. But I brought it up as far as how much I've had to learn about a true expression of sexuality, how little that has to do with how can I put it? How it's not an exclusively mechanistic thing. How intimacy begins at a very deep level.
Right, intimacy starts as you're passing each other in the, hallway by the refrigerator or something. It's like there's a, it's in all the little
Yeah.
moments and.
There's a movement which depends on two souls moving together, and the reason I brought up marriage partly is that anyone who's lived with the same woman for long enough, or if it's a woman with the same man, learns the hard way that our sexual expressions and experiences are totally different, and our idea of what is intimacy is totally different. And yeah, a man can just have purely physical intimacy and feel satisfied by that if he's staying at that shallow level of being a man, and generally a woman can't. But of course, this is not exclusive to the sexes, so there are women out there, such as the sex workers we're talking about, or just very promiscuous women who can take a more masculine approach and experience purely physical intimacy and feel like it's enough and they're owning their sexuality and all the rest of it. But I'm sorry, I will be blunt, it's bullshit. It's total bullshit because as a man, I mean, I was never able to be that even as a man, hard as I tried, but as a man now who's working through his trauma, sexuality is just so much more than the physical, even if you're going to pretend, or even if you're going to act as if it isn't, and even if all you experience is the physical and the hormonal pleasure and release of it, that doesn't mean there isn't all this other stuff going on at these much deeper levels, and as deep as the soul. Which, whatever that is, whatever that means, in the deepest layers of the unconscious, where the trauma is, where the pain is, where the poison is, and where real intimacy happens in those deeper levels. So, real intimacy actually can't happen as long as our unconscious is full of all of this trauma. So the traumatized get stuck in a surface level, and then we want to just carry on experiencing the pleasure and the satisfaction of intimacy slash sex at a surface level. But if you're in a relationship that's committed to an actual, a deeper intimacy, and maybe someday experience so-called sacred sexuality, I have to say I'm pretty skeptical about that whole concept at this point, but then that means going below the surface where the trauma is, and that may mean years and years of nothing happening at all.
True intimacy comes from truly going down on a woman. Going below the surface and going through the abyss together. It's,
I think it's down in yourself,
yeah.
actually. So, and that, we could, yeah, going down all the way into yourself and then meeting the other from that place that you've
Exactly.
been able to go into, yeah.
Can I want to throw just a sort of question at you. I don't think I ever got to this point before, but you sort of reminded me of something of when you said, again, these are loaded terms, feminine and masculine modes of thinking and receptivity. But I think we're trying to speak the same language, fully aware of how loaded it is.
Yeah.
I was starting to say before that I think modern day feminism is actually an incredibly masculine. It's like I don't think it's female empowerment. It's like women were taught, oh, you put on a pantsuit, you become a man. To be empowered as a woman is to achieve the things that are classically symbols of male power. So you can be a CEO, and you can put on a suit, and you can be the sexual instigator. You could be the one on top. You could be the, and in all the multitudes of meanings there. But basically, to me, it's a very masculine, modern feminism to me is a very masculine oriented thing, where it's a masculine version of a woman is seen as the power center there.
Right, which
And
is why it ends up with a prostitute, with
right.
the ultimate feminist being a prostitute, because that's the masculine's, the distorted masculine's dream, right? They want
Precisely, precisely. So it's the idea that right, it's still playing into the male fantasy. And I wondered when, this idea of the overarching idea of like how we as a society are finding it harder and harder to be intimate, I see even on the male female level, it's harder and harder to be intimate in that way because it's still the cultural programming comes from the sort of patriarchy, the male dominated society. So if we're all meeting that ideal, as you said, the woman has one idea of what it means to be sexually satisfied. The man has one idea of what it means to be sexually satisfied. And again, these are oversimplification, but if then society, all of society, takes on the idea of the sort of male satisfaction, there's this big empty void on the other side of what's actually being met, where the emotional is never met. So everything is reduced down to.
Yeah, it's more than the emotional, the inner space. And when you're talking about the masculine, feminine, and even the patriarchy, or especially patriarchy, I think it's, I mean, part of the point you're making is it's not about men and women, and it's not even necessarily about masculine and feminine, unless we want to get into a really sort of archetypal sense of yin and yang, which would be exteriorization versus interiority. So this is, I mean, it helped me see a kind of very clear-cut irony in the feminist thing, because I was thinking when you were speaking, well, it's not enough anymore, if it ever was, to say to feminist women or feminist men that, oh, the feminist woman is just a masculinized woman, because that's been obvious for decades, and nobody's, it doesn't seem to get through that argument. Clearly, it hasn't got through, even though the women I know would see it that way. So, but what you're describing is more succinctly, or can be put more succinctly, because feminism is about a masculine idea of empowerment. I mean, that's what you're saying, which is like the social criteria for what is empowerment or what is emancipation is an exterior-based criteria, i.e., masculine. So, for a woman to think that she can become fully a woman through exterior changes that is to become more and more exteriorized, i.e., become more and more masculine, as opposed to a woman who, the feminine being the interior space, which is literally true, of course, biologically true, the more powerful or true a woman becomes, the more she is able to tune into her inner essence, her inner space, and to connect to that power and express it, for it to be expressed. Whereas for men, there does seem to be, there's a cliche about woman is being and man is doing. There does seem to be something, and this is my experience about why I look forward to connecting to people, because I feel myself that it's through doing, through exterior activity, that I become more fully who I am as a man. And that, I think that is kind of fundamental, that women are passive and men are active. Now, I can feel the shekels on the feminist hides bristling, whatever the correct expression is, right? That's unsayable. How dare I suggest that women should just be passive while men, brutalize and rape them? Well, of course, that situation, I mean, how did that situation come about? Because if we want to look at the patriarchy, so-called, perhaps, well, certainly the primary unacknowledged cause for this patriarchal torture chamber in which we live is the abuse of mothers by their to their of their male children. That mothers are abusive of their children. They are statistically much more abusive of male children. A male child who is abused, particularly sexually, by his mother, will be possessed by his mother's psyche, and all of that violent expression of the patriarchy is a kind of latent expression of the feminine. I mean, that's a huge thesis statement and it'd take a lot of unpacking, but just putting it out there as like a sort of game changer or a spanner that's never acknowledged, you know.
Yeah, that sort of sets my mind reeling. Like, I could see multiple sort of avenues that could run down, but it does make sense as like a, again, if we can clearly see how in feminism, since it's more like in our faces culturally, like it's on, you know, like news and noteworthy, you know, we can see how the feminine world is sort of struggling. It's almost like so you inject the masculine archetype, you know, this sort of animus perhaps, but I think more almost like a sort of mind virus is how you're describing, is sort of like you inject the masculine programming into the feminine hardware, and what we're seeing played on the world stage in the feminist movement is the struggle of them trying to integrate their masculinity. And yet, probably, though much less talked about, is the masculine psychosis that comes with trying to integrate its feminine nature. Right, yeah, I totally see that, yeah.
And when you're trying to integrate a distorted masculine, a distorted feminine in place of the anima and animus, then it can never happen. Like, and you wouldn't want it to happen. Course, because then you would be fused with a tulpa, you know, with a traumatized fragment, and to some extent that is what has happened, of course. But because you can't fully integrate something that doesn't belong, that's been put in you like a poison. I've lost the thread of that sentence, but anyway,
yeah.
It doesn't ever happen. So the struggle goes on.
Yeah, I don't think I had really thought about the flip side of that, but that makes a total sense. And I think on a personal level, I could sort of see that, where I'm trying to... I have plenty of issues around my mother, and her psychosis runs deep in me.
Right.
So I see that on a personal level, but I sort of... Maybe, again, since we're trained to sort of focus on the individual and the personal development, I don't often project that outward or see.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't want to project it outward. I mean, you will be projecting outward without knowing it. It's the irony and the paradox. But in terms of actually recognizing that it's at play in society, again, we are ideologically programmed not to see that. And actually, the only way to see it, and I would say the only reason you're able to see this yourself is because you've recognized it in yourself. And an ideology is, back to that thing, is a way not to. You know, a way to stay in the constructed identity where you don't have to see that we've been infiltrated, polluted, traumatized, invaded, violated, all the rest of it. And it reframe, you know, with that, when you replace ideology with experience, it reframes the whole thing so that... you can barely even talk about it. Like we're making a valiant effort to talk about. So who would have thought we'd end up talking about feminism today, right? Although it's not a surprise to me, because as I say, I was getting sucked into something at this forum, but I didn't feel like I directed it to feminism, even though I mentioned it. But yeah, it's. Well, I don't know if I actually have a further thought there, just that I mean, I think of Blade Runner. Let me tell you about your my mother. For something like, you know, it's part of the way you hide the truth is you turn it into a cliche. And yeah, you and I are not in a podcast to talk about our mothers. Like, that's kind of unthinkable. And yeah, if we're really talking, if we're really going into our own deepness, depths, we will. That's where we'll end up.
Oh yeah,
really? It's more than a cliche.
It is a cliche. It's a total cliche. But I've had at least three personal, intimate conversations with fellow figures, you know, recognizable figures, where we've just sort of fully admitted, like, that the breakthrough that came with fully acknowledging, oh my God, you know, it's, again, it's a cliche, but it's like, I'm so, like, a lot of my anxiety or my hang-ups, all these things, God damn, it really does all go back to my mother. It's like, it's like, it sounds like such a silly thing to say, but it is so brutally true, and I've done everything possible to try and deny that. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it's like, it's just such a sort of like shortcut answer. I mean, I was writing a book, you know, like, just told, like, you know, the parents, like, it's, of course it's all so fucking personal. Like, I was writing this book that was about, like, Osiris and, you know, JFK and all this stuff and, you know, all these ideas that I was, like, 200 pages into it, and I was, oh, fuck, I'm writing about my daddy issues. And I was like, yeah. I haven't touched it, I haven't come back to the book. It's like, I don't think I'm really need to write a book about Osiris and JFK. I think I need to figure out what the fuck my daddy issues are. You know, it's like, and in one respect, okay. The book was a process in which to do it, but it was almost, yeah, like it was the path that got me to the realization, and I may one day return to the book, but for now, at least, it was like, no, it got me to this point where I need to sit with this longer. Like, what am I really, what, I have to work through my bullshit before I can talk about any of the external bullshit, if that makes sense.
Well, this is, yes, of course. I mean, like, to see you and raise you, and this has been my process the last few books, they always end up being going into my own trauma, and that to me, I mean, it happened with the last book I published. I could barely finish it because it went so deep and so dark so quickly that I thought maybe it would capsize the whole thing. And at least one reader felt it did. She felt like, oh, you need to take that out, it's too dark. That was seen and not seen. But I didn't take it out. And so what's been happening for me then is that the writing has become more and more an individuatory tool, and therefore the books have become the means to that end, not that it's over, but also then the descriptions of it. So, like, I would, you know, I wouldn't probably, you know, to be as honest as I'm want to be, I probably wouldn't want to read Alan Green's book about Osiris and JFK, but if I knew that it ended up with Alan Green talking about his father issues, then I might well read it. Because it's rubber meeting the road.
Yeah. Well, precisely. It's like, it felt like everything I was doing before that was still just sort of figuring. I didn't even find the road until that moment. Mm-hmm. So it's also like, it might be, I almost feel like, well, everything that I wrote there before that is like an interesting set of synchronicities, you know, it's a collecting lists and lists and lists of, I mean, it's not a book of lists, but I'm saying, like, you know, trying to narrate a sort of archetypal narrative that I see playing out through American history and such, which is interesting on one level, but I have to say, on a like, there's probably a thousand people who are into JFK stuff that might find that interesting. But I don't know if I do anymore. Like
Sure, yeah.
I'm sort of again, it's really when it's about going into myself and a sort of I think, you know, we talk about what is the point of waking up every day and all that sort of stuff. Again, for me, it is, I think it's the waves of it come and go, but I think it's waiting for that moment in the future. But I feel like I will one day break out of this and come back and do more writing and perhaps read, you know, be able to develop these ideas in a different fashion. I'm not like holding my breath for that. I'm not like planning for that. I'm just saying, like, I do see like this whole process right now, this cocooning process. Like, at some point, I expect to break out of that cocoon.
Good luck.
Well,
I don't know how long I've been, how many
right.
times I've thought, this is it! I can see the light! It's a crack!
Well, maybe it's yeah, fuck. If I get tongue-tied and I can't find no words for you to make us alright, so much for required.
So many times I back down, branded you a fool. If I could rewind, I'd open all the deepest wounds.
Statement to say, like, because the cocoon metaphor implies you're gonna blossom into this fully realized thing. I don't even mean.
It does, but it doesn't. Because if you want to really unpack the metaphor, it means you're just going to get broken down to liquids and there will be nothing left. And then out of those liquids, that new thing will form, right?
Right.
So it's back to being skinned alive, you know, individuation as experienced viscerally, when you're really in the cooker, when you're really aware of it. The thing that we're waiting to happen is for the end of the part of us that's waiting for it to happen, right? I tried to say that in a way I haven't said it before, right? We're waiting for us to end, to be over, so that the real life can come in. So that's why I feel every day I'm just waiting to die. I'm just waiting to die. Every day I have that absolute awareness. I'm thinking about the next TV show. No, I'm just waiting to die. So, and that has the literal sense that I'm just marking time and treading water until this body drops away, and then, I will find out. And that's the worst case scenario. And then the metaphorical interpretation that I'm waiting for this constructed identity to finally fall away and just give up, for the guardian to give up, protecting the false treasure, and just let life, flood through, flood, drown me, just let myself go under.
Can I be like exceptionally blunt with you?
I wish you would, because last time you said blunt, I wasn't too impressed by your
Well, my
bluntness, I mean.
bluntness is that I can't. I'm recognizing my own limitation that I don't know how to have this conversation in a recorded format. I don't even, I think it might even be hard to do it in a non-recorded format, but I don't know how to not be conscious of it and to hold back in the sense that, like, what you're saying is really harshly true for me in that I do feel like treading water, and I'm keeping this possibility of maybe if I tread water long enough, things will change. If I could just make it through, like over the summer, I thought I'll get through the summer and I'll save up some money and then I can do something different in the winter. And I'm like, well, if I could just make it through the winter and then in the spring, maybe we'll move again. Maybe we'll, my lease is up in April. Maybe we'll go somewhere else. What is the next thing I can? What is the next project I could take on? What is the whatever? But it really feels like just treading water, and I don't know how. But what I'm saying is, like, if you feel able to speak about this, I just want you to know that I understand, and I can sort of, I don't know, sympathize or empathize or whatever. But I don't know how to talk about. Like, I don't know what to. It's the really dark truth that I try very hard to hide at all. And like all the things that come into like okay, in the weird sort of ego, like culture of cult of personality thing of like, so what would making it mean? And like for me, like I would be right now, I'd be satisfied to like not have to have a day job would be a level of making it for me. But it's almost like even that level of quote unquote making it almost like it feels like how careful do you have to be about what you say, how you present yourself, all these sorts of things.
Right. In order to make it, you mean?
Right. And it,
But then, of course, what if you did make it? You'd have to be even more careful to
right.
keep
Yeah,
it.
I see how that sand trap works. Like, it's, I mean, did I see recently that did you post an article on Disinfo?
Yeah, I've been not writing for them exactly, but just in summing up the pieces at my blog there to direct more traffic to
Precisely. I
my
started
blog.
doing that as well. And
At Disinfo?
at Disinfo. That's how I saw you there because I was watching Disinfo. I was paying a lot of attention to Disinfo in the last few months just to see what kind of traction are things getting, like doing the sort of bullshit like measuring dick size of like, okay, well, like, but just to sort of say like, am I doing this right? Oh, that post got 300 shares. My post got, you know, whatever. Like all that sort of shit. Just like, how is this working? What all the questions around it. And then I was like, wait a second, I've got a Horsley's post in here too. Okay. But I know you've done things like this where you've written articles for lots of different sites and all this sort of stuff. So I don't know, maybe this is just par for the course, but like I've really been thinking a lot lately about this. And then this is a bullshit way of me sort of copping out of that other subject. But it is, it's another equally valid thing that I want to sort of talk to you about. It's like, so like when we measure artistic merit, like in your article, you're talking about your brother and like, what is that, you know, you say something on the lines of like, what does that mean that people value this as a statement? At what cost, or what is that? What can you take out of that? What can you?
Because he turned, the context being that he turned his self-destruction, his death was seen as an artwork, and people were admiring the artwork of his self-destruction.
Right? But you and I have discussed like what is even like the value of anybody admiring a piece of artwork.
Anyway, right? Yeah, absolutely.
You know, whether it's a destructive one or not. And again, like I'm not gonna lie. Like for me, it's very impulsive. Like I want to create, so that doesn't ultimately. The question of what is the value of appreciating art is an interesting concept, but that doesn't. It's not ultimately gonna stop me from pursuing it, and clearly not for you either, because you're still producing. So as much as we can doubt or question or debate the merits of even our own actions, we're still pursuing them.
Well, the producing is not necessarily pursuing. Like, and even the going to disinformation and checking your shares and all. So there's double meaning there. You know, the externals of that don't necessarily represent the internals. So, like, for me, if my, the closest I can come to a real objective in my life that, I don't know how to put it because it's not quite accurate this way, but that nullifies the feeling of futility, that injects actual meaning that is meaningful, as in that transcends this life, this identity, if that is about connecting to other sentient souls who will also exist after I die, after we both die, or we all die, a meaning that at least transcends this little life, right? If one of the means to that is amplifying my signal and not being admired, because I think that there's no benefit.
Sure,
that.
Yeah.
But
I actually think being admired is a fucking a hindrance.
It is a hindrance because people won't be as honest and direct with you, and there's all kinds of ways we could talk about that, so let's not even bother. But in terms of reaching more people and even supporting oneself, those can be valid means to a deeper end, which isn't to say that they are, and of course one can use that right away as, oh, I've now got a rationalization for my neuroses, right? So the self-examination never ends as far as, am I doing it for the right reasons? You know, is this truly part of that interior, you know, movement, the thing that's moving from deep within to come into form? Who knows, you know? It's like, that's a case-specific thing every time. Every time I open my mouth to say the next sentence to you, you know, is that, am I validating, or am I trying to get validation, or am I, etc., etc., or is this expressing something that will actually, you know, be, reach you in a deeper place, because it's coming from a deeper place in me.
Right.
And, you know, to be honest, to be experiential, I'm, if I'm not almost on the verge of tears these days, I don't feel like I'm really reaching deep enough.
Right.
So, and I do feel kind of like on the verge of tears right now, so that's good. I feel like I'm doing good. And so to bring it back to the point that you wanted to avoid, the treading water and the awful terror of the depths of our unprocessed sorrow and trauma, that is what I want to be experiencing, and that is actually what gives meaning. It's a real sort of head fuck, because it's like giving in to the futility, and it's not just the futility, it's that the actions we do that are futile and that we know are futile is because they're actions to keep us out of the awareness of those depths of you know, whatever. I don't want to just say pain and sorrow, it's not all bad. The depths of our souls, we just would do anything to keep our heads above the water of our own souls, but we don't want to have our heads above the water of our souls. We actually want to be absorbed into them, just as we want to go all the way into the chrysalis, or have, you know, be completely dissolved inside the chrysalis, so that we're no longer in that horrible putrefaction phase, you know, so that something can actually start coming into form. Although I don't think it is it's not a linear process, but yeah.
I'm sorry. What you said about, you know, we don't actually want to keep our heads above our souls. We want to, you know, go fully into it. I was picturing the Jake Katza blog with the big sign that says "Sink, don't swim," and I was like, "Oh my gosh,
you got it."
It's so funny. I was just picturing an alternate universe in which you guys were saying the same thing.
Well, I think
no, please don't read too much. It was a moment of like something just clicked in my mind, and I couldn't hold back the smile on my face, and I didn't want you to think that I was smiling at you sitting there going pain and sorrow. And I'm like,
it would be an appropriate response, I think, and not a sadistic gleeful smile, of course, but I think I smile more, you know, the more I connect to my to all that stuff, the more I'm able to smile. So
yeah,
there is a real joy in letting go. There really is. I mean, why wouldn't there be? Right? It's exhausting to hold on, and the sink or swim thing. I mean, that as a maxim is, it does sum up. I mean, sink, don't swim. It does sum up quite well what I'm saying, and to some extent, or some of what I'm saying, and this whole thing of coping and how overrated it is. Like, we have to cope. No, you don't have to cope. You don't have to go to your job. You don't have to be a good husband. You don't have to be a spiritual person. You don't have to, you know, etc.
Well,
you fill in the blank. You just don't.
But, all right, maybe this is the What's the alternative? Like, okay, so as much as I like, I find the struggle fairly futile, the alternative seems even worse. So yes, no one is holding a gun to my head that says, get up and go to work, be a good husband. You know,
you've got the inner gun to your inner head.
Well, yes, but it's the gun that's to my head is the alternative, you know, mm-hmm. like, so unless I was going to out and out kill myself.
Well, that's ideological thinking, no, almost, because you jump from one extreme to the other.
No, sorry, what I'm saying is, unless I were to do that, right, if I'm still living, if I'm going to be a living, breathing Alan,
and
I don't go to work, and I don't actually try.
Right. But that's not sinking.
Well, that's a cyber. That's like I would suddenly find myself in a quicksand of not having a roof over my head, not having a wife to love me.
You probably would. I mean, you can deduce the odds or calculate the odds and say this is likely to happen, but you actually don't know it. It's the first point to raise to yourself. I do not know this. I do not know what happened. You know,
you're
supposed
I've
to be a synchronistic.
I've tried before. When
yeah, I know, but that's not a synchronistic viewpoint either. Like, just because it happened last time, I mean, even the apple might not fall the next time, right? So, you know that the universe is sentient and that you're not separate from it, and that theoretically, if you gave up your job, you don't know that. The act of giving up your job might not free up a space in which something comes in, and I'm just using this as the example you raised, not as a, some sort of prescriptive behavior, obviously, but just because, I mean, you're just giving the standard answer. You know, I can't give up my job because dot dot dot. I can't.
The standard answer.
But that's coping.
You'll defeat it. I'm telling you.
Sure.
This is. I know it's a bullshit thing to say. I also don't. I'm at the point where I'm like. Holy fuck, like, I'm starting to feel my age, I'm starting to feel, like, how tired I am after, when I come home from work, where I used to, you know, like, I could fucking pull an all-nighter every fucking night, and I could go to work, and then I come home, and I fucking write all night, and then I whatever, and I'm not a party person, that's the thing, I'm not a anything like that. I am like probably like a weird fucked up sort of workaholic, but it's like I would go to a day job, come home and just work at my computer and just fucking do all this shit, and I produce stuff, and then I go back and I keep doing, and I wouldn't, you know, and like I find this whole thing like a struggle, and then when I don't feel like a real solid outcome from it, it starts to be like, I also feel like that's slipping from my hands, where it's like this is getting harder and the doubt is getting louder of like, what the fuck are you doing this for? Why are you pushing so hard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then that's a good question.
Yeah, it's a good fucking
and you know, giving up or letting go of the coping mechanism isn't it's not a question of literally quitting your job, much less committing suicide. It's like the pursuit, it's letting go of the pursuit. So you go to your job because you need the money in order to be secure, in order to pursue these other goals that are someday are going to make, transform you and your life into the thing you want it to be. So that's your coping mechanism. It's not the job, it's the context that you put the job into that makes it meaningful. So what I'm prescribing, and not for you, it's for me, like I'm not preaching from my pulpit, I'm struggling to embody this and talking about it is one of the ways I struggle, letting go of the whole idea of achieving anything in life, and just well, I don't know how to end that without a cliche, as in live in the now, or you know, just accept what is, and all those other platitudes that have become meaningless to us. And anyway, I prefer a gloomy, down, pessimistic view. I think there's more energy in it, because then it's actually, you get to experience what it is like on the other side of you know, whatever, the other side of the thing we're trying to get to, which is defeat. You know, there's nothing, and you're an American, so I'm saying it for that reason, there's nothing more un-American than defeat. And accepting defeat.
Totally.
It's just like you're a traitor. You're a traitor to your ideology if you kind of cease to invest in that prescribed agenda of pursuing your happiness. Right? Like that's what you've been programmed, socially conditioned to do, is pursue happiness. And that, you know, I was thinking that earlier with the sex workers and that whole thing between around there, that all that stuff is only, it only can be defended or explained or contextualized in a way that, oh, what's the problem, if you acknowledge or if you believe in that we're just here to pursue happiness. If that's your underlying philosophy and ideology, then by all means anything can be justified, of course, including murder, torture, rape and all the rest of it. But we don't have to go there, but you know, certainly any number of sort of distortions of our own sense of what's true or real.
No, I mean, that's a very profound thing to say. And I want you to know that it's sort of, it makes a point, your point comes across to me, even if you're speaking to yourself, it sort of hits me as a, what is it that we're, you know, what does it mean to succeed or to hold, what are you holding on to, and what are all the pieces in place? And I still, there's a, I think this is, has to do with my current setting, or just my current headspace. But it's like I'm finding it very hard to imagine otherwise, that and this is American programming of like, you gotta keep pushing. But I think I've seen so many people not push and not get anywhere. And
yeah, you're not going to find role models of the Zen and the art of accepting defeat.
Right.
I mean, there aren't, really. So the people that you're talking about, I imagine, if they don't become drug addicts, they just sit around, watch TV, get fat. I mean, that's just the flip side. They're also pursuing their happiness. They're just saying, fuck it, fuck everything, I'm not going to push, but they're still pursuing their happiness, as in comforts, right?
Right, right. Like I've, you know, my yeah, right. Is that's dark. That's fucked up, right? Because I'm like, you know, it's like I'm thinking about all the people who, right? They go home and they watch, you know, 12 hours of Walking Dead or whatever the fuck, and you know, eat mm-hmm. ranch flavored Domino's pizza, and I'm going home, but I'm gonna work every goddamn night on this video that I'm going to put out. I'm going to fucking put out this thing, and to say that that's the same impulse goes against everything that my ego holds, right? To say like, no, this isn't the word I really want to use, like the righteous, like I'm going home and I'm doing some shit. I'm doing real shit. Right? And I'm not, it's again, it's the masculine, feminine, passive, active. I'm not just, mm-hmm. you know, slipping into oblivion. I'm swimming upstream. I'm forging ahead, all this sort of shit. But it's almost like when I asked you about disinfo, the reason I found it interesting because, and again, it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive, but I always find it interesting, like, to hear some people say, I'm not really pursuing anything, but I still see they have a sort of, for lack of a term, sort of machinery in place of promotions and getting, you know, as you say, amplifying your signal, which mm-hmm. could seem hypocritical, but it's, and I'm not accusing you of such. What I'm saying is, it's almost like we become schizoid men, where we're like we have a thing to. Oh, just a heads up, my Skype recorder just crashed, so I don't know.
Okay.
But we sort of have the for lack of a term, you know, like an id, sort of like the thing that wants to pursue the artwork, and then the, again, for lack of a better term, a sort of ego coming in and be like, oh, what do you need help with? Oh, you want me to sign up for disinfo? You want me to like, okay, should I spend mm-hmm. 5 hours on Facebook letting everyone know about this thing you did? What next? Oh, do I what do I do? I need to do something. I need to do something. And it's mm-hmm. Sort of trying to divide between artistic pursuit and artistic, for lack of a better term, marketing, you know, like getting it out there, right? And I think, and again, this is not a particularly controversial thing to say, but it's not a particularly sexy thing to say, but I don't think we should be ashamed that we're trying to amplify our signal. So again, it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive, but it's almost...
Well, they don't have to be separate either.
Right, but I think there's something to be said for, like, that but maybe to that those two halves of us, the promotional part of us and the deep dreaming artistic side of us, to every now and then check in and make sure they're on the same page. That the guy that's
but that's what I mean, that they don't have to be separate. I don't see it that way. I see it as interior exterior. So, I had a thought earlier, but I think I've lost it. But in terms of the promotional thing, that's exterior, but then so is the producing. So, like there's in this interior process that I'm in, that does seem to not just include, but to some extent depend upon producing these works that are for people, and that's the exteriorization of the internal, hopefully not in a way that's projecting and disowning, but in a way that's bringing it into form. And then the promotional aspect is that's just a little nub or a little crustacean on the larger thing of the production. I don't see it as coming from a separate part of me. I do something, I'm really happy about it. Oh, I'll just sum it up a bit and put it at disinfo. That's also, creative, whatever. It's engaging the same part of me to shape it in a way that will disinfo readers will receive it, and then it's linked to the blog. And so that I see that all. That's just the productive process. Like I wouldn't even use the term creative. The creative process is an internal thing, and then when I'm actually writing and shaping it, that's production. That's just creating a something that is out there for the world. But the interior process doesn't end when I'm doing that, because there's the constant self-observation of how is this affecting my interior process doing this? Is it actually distracting from it and undermining it, or is it helping to amplify the real signal, the signal inside me?
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
So there ends part two of my conversation with Alan Green of thesyncbook.com. I did actually carry on talking to Alan for another hour or more. Some of that, the good parts of the remainder of our conversation, are available at horticulture.com/liminalist. The reason I decided to end here with this part is that the energy levels began to decrease after the first couple of hours, and I felt that we weren't really in the flow anymore, but we still did cover some interesting stuff, so those who want the full Monty can listen to that third audio. Obviously, if you want to, that's pretty much it. I'd like to thank Dominic and Pam for donating to the Liminalist, and I'd like to thank Stephen for subscribing. If you'd like to make a one-time donation or regular monthly donations, you can do so at the website horticulture.com in the margin of any page besides the homepage. I'm continuing to post regularly, twice weekly, at the blog horticulture.wordpress.com, the Occult Yorkshire series looking into Fabianism, pedophile rings, social engineering, and my family history. So if you'd like to participate there, you're very welcome to do so. Also, I'm continuing to explore the Kubricon, whatever that is now, its current state of mutation, at the Rigorous Intuition Forum that I frequent, and I will link to that in the show notes, even though Alan and I didn't talk about Kubrick at all. Axie and KubraCon really doesn't have very much to do with Kubra. Which I may have stitched myself up there. But anyway, that's it for one more week. Till next week, thanks for listening. Jason Horsley in the Liminal Realm.
And this was all the monkey spoke when his word came.